21. Howie Gold finished his private conference with Terry at 8:40 p.m., a full 10 minutes before the half hour he had been allotted was up. By then, Ralph and Bill Samuels had been joined by Troy Ramage and Stephanie Gould, a patrol woman who had come on duty at 8. She had a DNA kit still in its plastic bag. Ignoring Howie's oy vey big trouble comment, Ralph asked the lawyer if he and his client would okay a DNA swab. Howie was holding the door to the interview room open with his foot so it wouldn't relock. "They want to take cheek swabs, Terry. You okay with that? They're going to get them anyway, and I need to make a couple of quick phone calls." "All right," Terry said. Dark circles had begun to form under his eyes, but he sounded calm. "Let's do everything we have to do so I can get out of here before midnight." The man sounded absolutely sure that was going to happen. Ralph and Samuels exchanged a glance. Samuels raised his eyebrows, which made him look more like Alfalfa than ever. "Call my wife," Terry said. "Tell her I'm okay." Howie grinned. "Number one on my list." "Go up to the end of the hall," Ralph said. "You'll get 5 bars. "I know," Howie said. "I've been here before. It's kind of like reincarnation." And to Terry, "Say nothing until I get back." Officer Ramage took the swabs, one from each inner cheek, and held them up to the camera before putting each into its little vial. Officer Gould placed the vials back in the bag and held it up to the camera as she sealed it with a red evidence sticker. She then signed the chain of custody sheet. The two officers would take the samples down to the closet-sized room that served as the Flint City PD's evidence locker. There it would once more be shown to an overhead camera before being filed. 2 more officers, probably state police, would convey it to Cap City the following day. Chain of evidence, therefore, remains intact, as Dr. Bogan would have said, which might sound a bit prissy, but was no joke. Ralph intended that there should be absolutely no weak links in that chain, no slip-ups, no way to break free. Not in this case. D.A. Samuels started to return to the interview room while Howie was making his calls by the door to the main office, but Ralph held him back, wanting to listen. Howie conversed briefly with Terry's wife. Ralph heard him say, "It's going to be okay, Marcy," and then made a second, even briefer call, telling someone where Terry's daughters were and reminding the someone that there would be press clogging up Barnum Court and to proceed accordingly. Then he came back to the interview room. "Okay, let's see if we can't sort this mess out." Ralph and Samuel sat down across the table from Terry. The chair between them remained vacant. Howie elected to stand beside his client, a hand on his shoulder. Smiling, Samuels began. "You like little boys, don't you, Coach?" There was no hesitation on Terry's part. "Very much. I also like little girls, having 2 of my own." "And I'm sure your daughters play sports. With Coach T for a dad, how could they not? But you don't coach any girls' teams, do you? No soccer, no softball, no lacrosse. You stick to the boys. Baseball in the summer, Pop Warner in the fall, and Y basketball in the winter, although I guess you just spectate at that one. All those Saturday afternoon trips to the Y were what you might call scouting expeditions, right? Looking for boys with speed and agility, and maybe checking out how they looked in their shorts while you were at it." Ralph waited for Howie to put a stop to this, but Howie kept silent, at least for the time being. His face had become an absolute blank, nothing moving but the eyes, going from one speaker to the next. "He's probably one hell of a poker player," Ralph thought. Terry, however, had actually begun to smile.
"You got that from Willow Rainwater. Must have. She's a piece of work, isn't she? You should hear her bellowing on Saturday afternoons. Box out! Box out! Pick up your feet! Now go to the hole!" "How's she doing?"
"You tell me," Samuel said. "After all, you saw her Tuesday night."
"I didn't." Howie grabbed Terry's shoulder and squeezed before he could say anything else.
"Why don't we stop interrogation 101, okay? Just tell us why Terry's here. Lay it out."
"Tell us where you were on Tuesday," Samuel countered. "You started. Go ahead and finish."
"I was..." But Howie Gold squeezed Terry's shoulder again, this time harder, before he could go on.
No, Bill, it's not going to work that way. Tell us what you've got, or I'll go right to the press and tell them you've arrested one of Flint City's premier citizens for the murder of Frank Peterson, thrown mud all over his reputation, terrified his wife and daughters, and won't say why.
Samuels looked at Ralph, who shrugged. If the DA hadn't been present, Ralph would already have been laying out the evidence in hopes of a quick confession.
Go on, Bill, Howie said. This man needs to get home and be with his family.
Samuel smiled, but there was no humor in his eyes. It was your basic show of teeth.
He'll see them in court, Howard, at the arraignment on Monday.
Ralph could feel the fabric of civility fraying and put most of the blame for that on Bill, who was genuinely enraged at the crime and at the man who had done the crime, as anyone would be. But that didn't pull the plow, as Ralph's grandfather would have said.
Hey, before we get started, I've got a question,
Ralph said, striving for cheeriness.
Just one. Okay, counselor? It's nothing we won't find out anyway.
Howie seemed grateful enough to turn his attention away from Samuels.
Let's hear it. What's your blood type, Terry? Do you know?
Terry looked at Howie, who shrugged, then back at Ralph.
I ought to. I give 6 times a year at the Red Cross because it's pretty rare. AB positive.
Terry blinked.
How did you know that?
And then, realizing what the answer must be.
But not that rare. If you want really rare, you want AB negative. 1% of the population. The Red Cross has people with that type on speed dial, believe me.
When it comes to rare, I always think of fingerprints, Samuels remarked, as if just passing the time of day. I suppose because they come up so often in court.
Where they rarely figure in the jury's decision, Howie said.
Samuels ignored him.
No two sets exactly alike. There are even minute variations in the prints of identical twins. You don't happen to have an identical twin, do you, Terry?
You're not saying you have mine at the scene where the Peterson boy was killed, are you?
Terry's expression was pure incredulity. Ralph had to give it to him. He was a hell of an actor, and apparently meant to play the string out right to the end.
We've got so many fingerprints I can barely count them, Ralph said. They're all over the white van you used to abduct the Peterson boy. They're on the boy's bike, which we found in the back of the van. They're on the toolbox that was in the van. They're all over the Subaru you switched to behind Shorty's pub. He paused. And they're on the branch that was used to sodomize the Peterson boy, an attack so vicious that the internal injuries alone might well have killed him.
No need for fingerprint powder or UV light on those, Samuel said. Those prints are in the boy's blood.
This was where most perps, like 95%, would break down, lawyer or no lawyer. Not this one. Ralph saw shock and amazement on the man's face, but no guilt. Howie rallied.
You have prints, fine. It wouldn't be the first time fingerprints were planted.
A few, maybe, Ralph said. But 70, 80, and in blood on the weapon itself?
We also have a chain of witnesses, Samuel said. He began ticking them off on his fingers. You were seen accosting Peterson in the parking lot of Gerald's Fine Groceries. You were seen putting his bicycle in the back of the van you used. He was seen getting into the van with you. You were seen exiting the woods where the murder took place, covered with blood. I could go on, but my mother always told me that I should save some for later.
Eyewitnesses are rarely reliable, Howie said. The fingerprints are iffy. But eyewitnesses, he shook his head.
Ralph jumped in.
I'd agree, at least in most cases. Not in this one. I interviewed someone recently who said Flint City is really just a small town. I don't know if I buy that completely, but the West Side is pretty tightly knit, and Mr. Maitland here is widely known. Terry, the woman who ID'd you at Gerald's is a neighbor, and the girl who saw you coming out of the woods in Figgis Park knows you very well. Not just because she lives a little way down from you on Barnum Street, but because you once brought back her lost dog.
June Morris? Terry was looking at Ralph with frank disbelief. Junie?
There are others, Samuel said. Many.
Willow? Terry sounded out of breath as if he'd been punched. Her too?
Many, Samuels repeated. Every one of them picked you out of six packs, Ralph said. No hesitation.
And was the photo of my client perhaps wearing a golden dragon's cap and a shirt with a big C on it? Howie asked. Was that one perhaps tapped by the finger of the questioning officer?
You know better, Ralph said. At least I hope you do.
Terry said, this is a nightmare.
Samuel smiled sympathetically.
I understand that, and all you have to do to end it is to tell us why you did it.
As if there might be a reason on God's green earth that any sane person could understand, Ralph thought.
It might make a difference,
Samuels was almost wheedling now,
but you should do it before the DNA comes back. We've got plenty, and when it matches those cheek swabs...
He shrugged.
Tell us, Ralph said. I don't know if it was temporary insanity or something you did in a fugue state or a sexual compulsion or just what, but tell us.
He heard his voice rising, thought about clamping down on it, then thought, what the hell? Be a man and tell us!
Speaking more to himself than to the men on the other side of the table, Terry said, I don't know how any of this can be. I wasn't even in town on Tuesday.
Where were you then? Samuels asked. Go ahead, lay it on us. I love a good story. Read my way through most of Agatha Christie in high school.
Terry turned to look up at Gold, who nodded. But Ralph thought Howie looked worried now. The stuff about the blood type and the fingerprints had rocked him hard. The eyewitnesses even harder. He'd been rocked most of all, perhaps, by little Junie Morris, whose lost dog had been returned by good old reliable Coach T.
I was in Cap City. Left at 10 on Tuesday morning. Got back late Wednesday night. Well, 9:30 or so late for me.
I don't suppose you had anyone with you, Samuel said. Just off on your own and kind of gathering your thoughts, right? Getting ready for the big game?
Did you take your car or the white van?
By the way, where did you have that van stashed? And how did you happen to steal one with New York plates in the first place? I've got a theory about that, but I'd love to have you confirm or deny.
Do you want to hear this or not? Terry asked. He had, incredibly, begun to smile again. Maybe you're afraid to hear it. And maybe you should be afraid. You're in shit up to your waist, Mr. Samuels, and it's getting deeper.
Is that so? Then why am I the one who can walk out of here and go home when this interview is over?
Cool it, Ralph said quietly.
Samuels turned to him, cowlick springing back and forth. Ralph saw nothing comical about it now.
Don't tell me to cool it, detective. We're sitting here with a man who raped a kid with a tree branch and then tore out his throat like a fucking cannibal.
Gold looked directly up at the camera in the corner, now speaking for some future judge and jury.
Stop acting like an angry child, Mr. District Attorney, or I'll terminate this interview right here.
I wasn't alone, Terry said, and I don't know anything about a white van. I went with Everett Roundhill, Billy Quaid, and Debbie Grant. The entire Flint High School English department, in other words. My expedition was in the shop because the air conditioner died. So we took Ev's car. He's the department chairman, and he's got a BMW. Plenty of room. We left from the high school at 10.
Samuels looked temporarily too perplexed by this to ask the obvious question, so Ralph did it. What was in Cap City that would take four English teachers there in the middle of summer vacation?
Harlan Coben, Terry said.
Who's Harlan Coben?
Bill Samuels asked. His interest in mystery stories had apparently peaked with Agatha Christie. Ralph knew. He wasn't much of a fiction reader, but his wife was.
The mystery writer?
The mystery writer, Terry agreed.
Look, there's a group called the Tri-State Teachers of English, and every year they hold a 3-day midsummer conference. It's the only time everyone can get together. There are seminars and panel discussions, that sort of thing. It's held in a different city each year. This year it was Cap City's turn. Only English teachers are like anyone else. It's hard to get them together even in summer because they've got so many other things going on. All the paint-up, fix-up stuff that didn't get done during the school year. family vacations plus various summer activities. For me, it's Little League and City League, so the TSTE always tries to get a big-name speaker as a draw for the middle day, which is when most attendees show up. Which in this case was last Tuesday? Ralph asked. Right. This year's conference was at the Sheraton from July 9th, the Monday, to July 11th, the Wednesday. I haven't been to one of those conferences in 5 years, but when Ev told me that Coben was going to be the keynote speaker and the other English teachers were going, I arranged for Gavin Frick and Babir Patel's dad to take the practices on Tuesday and Wednesday. It killed me to do it with the semifinal game coming up, but I knew I'd be back for the practices on Thursday and Friday, and I didn't want to miss Coben. I've read all his books. He's great on plot, and he has a sense of humor. Also, the theme of this year's conference was teaching popular adult fiction in grades 7 through 12, and that's been a hot-button issue for years, especially in this part of the country. Save the exposition, Samuel said. Get to the bottom line. Fine. We went. We were there for the banquet lunch. We were there for Coben's speech. We were there for the evening panel discussion at 8 p.m. We spent the night. Ev and Debbie had single rooms, but I split the cost of a double with Billy Quaid. That was his idea. He said he was building an addition on his house and had to economize. They'll vouch for me. He looked at Ralph and lifted his hands, palms out. I was there. That's the bottom line. Silence in the room. At last Samuel said, What time was Coben's speech? 3 o'clock, Terry said. 3 o'clock on Tuesday afternoon. How convenient, Samuel said acidly. Howie Gold smiled widely. Not for you. 3 o'clock, Ralph thought. Almost the same time that Arlene Stanhope claimed to have seen Terry putting Frank Peterson's bicycle into the back of the stolen white van and then riding away with the boy in the passenger seat. No, not even almost. Mrs. Stanhope said she'd heard the bell and the town hall clock announce the hour. The speech was in the Sheraton's big meeting room? Ralph asked. Yes, right across from the banquet room. And you're sure it started at 3? Well, that's when the TSTE chairman started her introduction, which droned on for at least 10 minutes. Uh-huh. And how long did Coben speak? I think about 45 minutes. After that, he took questions. It was probably 4:30 by the time he finished. Ralph's thoughts were whirling around in his head like loose paper caught in a draft. He could not remember ever having been so completely blindsided. They should have checked Terry's movements out in advance, but that was Monday morning quarterbacking. He, Samuels, and Yoon Sablo of the state police had all agreed that questions about Maitland ahead of his arrest would risk alerting a very dangerous man, and it had seemed unnecessary, given the weight of evidence. Now, however, he glanced at Samuels, but saw no immediate help there. The man's expression was a mixture of suspicion and perplexity. "You've made a bad mistake here," Gold said. "Surely you two gentlemen see that." "No mistake," Ralph said. "We have his prints. We have eyewitnesses who know him, and pretty soon we'll have the first DNA result. A match there will clinch it."
"Ah, but we may also have something else pretty soon," Gold said. "My investigator is on it as we speak, and confidence is high." "What?" Samuel snapped. Gold smiled. "Why spoil the surprise before we see what Alec comes up with? If what my client told me is correct, I think it's going to put another hole in your boat, Bill, and your boat is already leaking badly."
The Alec in question was Alec Pelly, a retired state police detective who now worked exclusively for lawyers defending criminal cases. He was expensive and good at his job. Once over drinks, Ralph had asked Pelly why he had gone over to the dark side. Pelly replied that he'd put away at least 4 men he later came to believe were innocent and felt he had a lot to atone for. Also, he'd said, retirement sucks if you don't play golf. No use speculating about what Pelly was chasing this time, always supposing it wasn't just some chimera or a defense attorney bluff. Ralph stared at Terry, again looking for guilt and seeing only worry, anger, and bewilderment. The expression of a man who has been arrested for something he hasn't done. Except he had done it. All the evidence said so. And the DNA would put the final nail in his coffin. His alibi was an artfully constructed piece of misdirection, something straight out of an Agatha Christie novel or one by Harlan Coben. Ralph would begin the job of dismantling the magic trick tomorrow morning, starting with interviews of Terry's colleagues and moving on to a back check of the conference, focusing on the start and end times of Coben's appearance. Even before beginning that work, his bread and butter, he saw one possible gap in Terry's alibi. Arlene Stanhope had seen Frank Peterson getting into the white van with Terry at 3. June Morris had seen Terry in Figgis Park, covered with blood, at around 6:30. The girl's mother had said the weather was on the local news when June left, and that pegged it. That left a gap of 3.5 hours. Which was more than enough time to drive the 70 miles from Cap City to Flint City. Suppose it hadn't been Terry Maitland Mrs. Stanhope had seen in the parking lot of Gerald's Fine Groceries. Suppose it had been an accomplice who looked like Terry, or maybe just dressed like Terry, in a Golden Dragon's cap and shirt. It seemed unlikely until you factored in Mrs. Stanhope's age and the thick glasses she'd been wearing.
"Are we done here, gentlemen?" Cold asked. "Because if you really intend to hold Mr. Maitland, I have a great deal to do. High on the list is speaking to the press. Not my favorite thing, but..."
"You lie," Samuel said sourly.
"But it may draw them away from Terry's house and give his children a chance to get indoors without being hounded and photographed. Most of all, it will give that family a little bit of the peace you have so recklessly stolen from them." "Save it for the TV cameras," Samuel said. He pointed to Terry, also playing for some judge and jury. "Your client tortured and murdered a child, and if his family is collateral damage, he himself is responsible."
"You're unbelievable," Terry said. "You didn't even question me before you arrested me. Not one single question."
Ralph said, "What did you do after the speech, Terry?"
Terry shook his head. Not in negation, but as if to clear it. "After? I got in line with everyone else. But we were pretty far back, thanks to Debbie. She had to use the bathroom and wanted us to wait for her so we'd all be together. She was gone for a long time. A lot of guys also broke for the Johns as soon as the Q&A was over, but it always takes the women longer because, well, you know, only so many stalls. I went down to the newsstand with Ev and Billy, and we hung out there. By the time she met us, the line was all the way out into the lobby."
"What line?" Samuels asked.
"Do you live under a rock, Mr. Samuels? The autograph line. Everyone had a copy of his new book, I Told You I Would. It came with the price of the conference ticket. I've got mine signed and dated, and we'll be happy to show it to you. Assuming you haven't already taken it out of the house with the rest of my stuff, that is. By the time we got to the autograph table, it was past 5:30.
If so, Ralph thought, his imagined gap in Terry's alibi had just closed to a pinhole. It was theoretically possible to drive from Cap to Flint in an hour. The turnpike speed limit was 70, and the cops wouldn't give you a second look unless you were doing 85 or even 90. But how would Terry have had time to commit the murder? Unless the look-alike accomplice had done it. And how did that work, with Terry's fingerprints everywhere, including on the branch? Answer, it didn't. Also, why would Terry want an accomplice who looked like him, dressed like him, or both? Answer, he wouldn't.
"Were the other English teachers with you the whole time you were standing in line?" Samuels asked.
"Yes."
"The signing was also in the big room?"
"Yes, I think they call it the ballroom."
"And once you all had your autographs, what did you do then?"
went out to dinner together with some English teachers from Broken Arrow we met while we were standing in line.
Out to dinner where? Ralph asked.
Place called the Fire Pit. It's a steakhouse about 3 blocks from the hotel. Got there around 6, had a couple of drinks before, had dessert after. It was a good time. He said this almost wistfully. There were 9 of us in all, I think. We walked back to the hotel together and sat in on the evening panel, which had to do with how to handle challenges to books like To Kill a Mockingbird and Slaughterhouse-5. Ev and Debbie left before it was over, but Billy and I stayed to the end.
Which was when? Ralph asked.
9:30 or so.
And then?
Billy and I had a beer in the bar, then we went up to the room and went to bed.
Listening to a speech by a noted mystery writer when the Peterson boy was snatched, Ralph thought.
Had dinner with at least 8 other people when the Peterson boy was killed.
Attending a panel discussion on banned books when Willow Rainwater claimed to have taken him in her cab from Gentlemen Please to the train station in Dubrow. He must know we'll go to his colleagues, that we'll track down the teachers from Broken Arrow, that we'll talk to the bartender in the Sheraton Lounge. He must know we'll check the hotel security footage and even the autograph in his copy of the latest Harlan Coben barn burner. He must know these things. He's not a stupid man. The conclusion that his story would check out was both unavoidable and unbelievable. Samuels leaned forward over the table, his chin jutting.
Do you expect us to believe that you were with others the entire time between 3 o'clock and 8 o'clock on Tuesday?
The entire time?
Terry gave him a look of which only high school teachers are capable. We both know you're an idiot, but I will not embarrass you in front of your peers by saying so.
Of course not. I used the John myself before Coben's speech started, and I went once at the restaurant.
Maybe you can convince a jury that I came back to Flint, killed poor Frankie Peterson, and returned to Cap City in the minute and a half it took me to empty my bladder. Think they'll buy it?
Samuels looked at Ralph. Ralph shrugged.
I think we have no further questions now, Samuels said. Mr. Maitland will be escorted to the county jail and kept in custody until his arraignment on Monday.
Terry's shoulders slumped.
You intend to go through with this, Gold said. You really do.
Ralph expected another explosion from Samuels, but this time the district attorney surprised him. He sounded almost as weary as Maitland looked.
Come on, Howie. You know I have no choice given the evidence. And when the DNA comes back a match, it's going to be game over.
He leaned forward again, once more invading Terry's space.
You still have a chance to avoid the needle, Terry. Not a good one, but it's there. I urge you to take it. Drop the bullshit and confess. Do it for Fred and Arlene Peterson, who've lost their son in the worst way imaginable. You'll feel better.
Terry did not draw back, as Samuels might have expected. He leaned forward instead, and it was the district attorney who pulled away, as if afraid the man on the other side of the table had something contagious that he, Samuels, might catch.
There is nothing to confess to, sir. I didn't kill Frankie Peterson. I would never hurt a child.
You have the wrong man. Samuels sighed and stood up.
Okay, you had your chance. Now, God help you.